will. A bit of additional information concerning the Kennedy assassination and Watergate that developed right here in the South Bay 4 years ago. Perhaps apocryphal, perhaps not. By the way, that is also available, that conversation in its entirety is available from Archives on Audio under the KOME Expressway Show, Conversation with Gordon Novell. So that is available on a separate tape. It's not part of the regular Guns of November series. Speaking of the Guns of November, we're now going to go back to Guns of November show number 3, this dealing with the Watergate scandal. More information on Watergate and the Kennedy assassination right now. For those of you who are taping, we're going to be going for about another hour or so. 3, 2, 1, here we go.
Counsel, the minority counsel was a guy named Albert Jenner, and he had been a Warren Commission counsel. So the Kennedy connection, that there are many minor ones. We're going to go into some of the major ones here in just a second.
Okay, one of the other things that needs to be mentioned in context of the Nixon tapes is that one of the things that Richard Nixon at one point was, I believe, and I don't remember the exact person he was arguing with or he was talking to, but it was one of his aides, Richard Nixon, and this is in the transcripts once once this came out, you can find it, I believe, in places, in a variety of places, but Richard Nixon said, literally, one of the reasons that the tapes should not be revealed because they were going to bring up this whole, and I quote Richard Nixon, this whole Bay of Pigs thing. Now, in and of itself, that is very interesting because, according to popular theory, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, embarrassing as it might have been for America, was all known. The Bay of Pigs invasion was started and it failed. Well, one has to ask a series of questions about why Richard Nixon would be so worried, and he was worried, as the conversation showed, about this whole Bay of Pigs thing. And we've talked in the past about his role in planning the Bay of Pigs, which was also pretty well known. But we've also mentioned two possibilities. One is the fact of the CIA scotching their own Bay of Pigs, and the other is the possibility that the scotching of the Bay of Pigs led in part to the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Okay, and worth noting, too, that Nixon ran against Kennedy in 1960, and the Bay of Pigs was one of Kennedy's main embarrassments. And here's Nixon trying to cover the thing up. Talking about also about the tape gaps, too. At one point, Nixon, and in his reference to the whole Bay of Pigs thing, at one point, Nixon was considering, in fact, asked former Warren Commission Chief Counsel J. Lee Rankin to go over the tapes to help edit out national security-related matter. Rankin declined, by the way. So, again, this the same cast of characters crops up. Now, last week, when we were talking about the evidentiary aspects of the Kennedy case, we talked about something called the single bullet theory. In a nutshell, and I mean in a nutshell, what this provides for is that a single bullet caused all 7 non-fatal wounds in President Kennedy and Governor Connally. There were 3 shots. 1 blew Kennedy's head clean off, 1 missed completely, which leaves a 3rd shot, and that one alone to account for 7 non-fatal wounds. If more than 1 shot is required to cause those wounds, the whole Warren Commission thesis goes down the tubes. Now, one of the things we looked at last week was the fact that something called neutron activation analysis had been performed upon the bullet fragments found in the Kennedy limousine. Now, under that test, basically, the fragments are bombarded with neutrons. They give off a spectrum which reveals the exact molecular structure of the substance. And this is a tremendous breakthrough in regard to forensic science, because this enables determination to be made about bullets and ballistics that had previously never, had totally eluded would-be investigators. Now, as we saw last week, the neutron activation analysis performed on the bullet fragments disproved the single bullet theory, which was physically impossible in a number of respects, but some of the bullet fragments which were found in the car were proved not to have come from CE-399, and this totally disproves the single bullet thesis. Now, one of the most noteworthy authorities on the Kennedy assassination, one of the sort of main men of the research, so to speak, is a fellow by the name of Harold Weisberg, last name Weisberg. We referred to some of his work last week. Harold Weisberg is a former FBI agent who's authored a number of different books on the Kennedy assassination. His most famous series is called Whitewash, and there are 4 volumes, volumes 1 through 4. Also wrote an excellent but very rare book called Oswald in New Orleans. Now, in 1970, Harold Weisberg and his attorney, a man named Jim Lazar, filed a Freedom of Information Act suit to oblige the Department of Justice and FBI to release the results of the spectrographic analysis of the JFK bullet fragments.
Something, again, should be mentioned just to bring you back up to the present. We are now talking about the Richard Nixon presidency's Justice Department that they were applying to for permission to get this spectro evidence released.
Exactly. And this is 1970. Now, this is 7 years after supposedly Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Freedom of Information Act specifically forbade the withholding of all information, of any information, because of national security or because of national interest. That was not regarded as one of the reasons why a given federal department could withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit. Now, what we've looked at in the past, and we're going to look at some of the amazing legal maneuvering that took place in connection with one or another aspect of the Kennedy assassination case. Now, it's worth noting here that, first of all, as everybody learned in high school, our government has three branches. There's the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. All right, Congress is legislative, president is executive, and the Supreme Court and courts are the judicial. Now, the Warren Commission was a presidential fact-finding commission. As such, it was part of the executive branch of the government. It was not part of the judicial branch. As a result, the Warren Commission had absolutely no legal status whatsoever. Keep this in mind, because some very, very strange things are going to occur. Now, when Jim Lazar, Harold Weisberg's attorney, filed a Freedom of Information Act suit, they received a number of different rebuffs from the Justice Department. Now, the only legal grounds upon which the Justice Department can withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit is if it pertains to an ongoing investigation and could in some way damage that or corrupt that. Now, of course, the official version with regard to the assassination of President Kennedy was that Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut, unaided, killed President Kennedy, and since he himself was then executed by the second lone nut, so to speak, Jack Ruby, all possible legal action in the case officially came to an end as of 11/24/63 with the death of Lee Harvey Oswald. So there was no ongoing legal action being pursued by the Justice Department, at least that we know of, and ongoing legal action is the only conceivable grounds that the Justice Department can use to withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit. Now, keep in mind that the FBI's spectrographic analyses were performed for the Warren Commission, which is not even part of the judicial branch of our government. It's part of the executive branch. Now, keep these things in mind, because we're going to see some very, very strange things occurring here. Now, I'm going to read you a couple of excerpts here from one of Harold Weisberg and Jim Lazar's books. It's called Whitewash, Volume 4. Okay? And the possible legal grounds for the Justice Department withholding evidence from the Freedom of Information Act suit is described here by Jim Lazar, writing in an appendix to Whitewash, Volume 4. There was only one conceivable legal justification which the Department of Justice could invoke, its old favorite, the exemption for, quote, investigatory files compiled for law enforcement purposes, unquote. But the purpose of the investigatory file exemption was to prevent premature discovery which, quote, could harm the government's case in court, unquote. Unless the government would admit to conspiracy, the only possible law enforcement action had expired on November 24, 1963, when Jack Ruby gunned down Lee Harvey Oswald, the government's only suspect. Moreover, the analyses had been done as part of an investigation the FBI made for the Warren Commission. Where the assassination was concerned, neither the FBI nor the Warren Commission had law enforcement powers. Indeed, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover testified before the Warren Commission that his agency had no jurisdiction to investigate the crime. The Warren Commission did have authority to investigate the assassination, but not for the purpose of prosecuting law violators. Its purpose was to establish the truth and report it to the president. Now, in spite of the fact that it had no legal basis for resisting Lazar and Weisberg's suit, the government did so, and not only did they attempt to prevent disclosure of the spectrographic evidence, but they went through a number of very strange legal maneuvers in order to do this. First of all, when the case was to be heard, the government filed an affidavit by an FBI agent named Marion Williams, which was regarded as a key piece of evidence. Now, the affidavit was filed at the last possible minute. It was filed so late that it did not give Jim Lazar, Weisberg's counsel, time to respond to it, and it was a key piece of evidence. This is worth noting because the affidavit itself was dated 2.5 months before it was filed, so that obviously they could have allowed Jim Lazar, Weisberg's counsel, to go over this 2.5 months in advance. They held this up to the very last minute, and the judge allowed them to do that. Now, in Whitewash Volume 4, the significance of the affidavit, again, by an FBI agent named Marion Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S, is covered as follows. Again, this from Whitewash Volume 4. The Williams affidavit was an absurd document. It contained at least one provably false statement, mischaracterized Weisberg's request for the results obtained from the spectrographic tests as a request for the release of raw data, unquote, and recited a catalog of speculative horrors which Williams said might ensue court-ordered release of the analyses. Quote, it could lead, for example, to exposure of confidential informants, the disclosure out of context of the names of suspected persons on whom criminal justice action is not yet complete, possible blackmail, and in general, do irreparable harm. And Jim Lazar goes on to comment here. The Williams affidavit was clearly preposterous. There is no way that releasing the spectrographic results could lead to the exposure of confidential informants or any of the other harms Williams imagined. Now, a hearing was set before the judge on this case. The government's attorney, a man named Robert Werdig, W-E-R-D-I-G, showed up very late for the hearing. The judge then announced that he was going to have to leave early because he had an appointment to keep. The judge's name, by the way, is John Sirica. Now, John Sirica is old Maximum John, the judge for the original Watergate case that in which the Watergate burglars were tried, and his steadfastness in pursuing that case is often credited with having, along with James McCord's letter, with having broken the Watergate case. So pay close attention to his actions here. Now, still later, the government's attorney, in arguing to prevent disclosure of the spectrographic evidence, argued basically that the Attorney General of the United States had determined that national interest would be harmed by the release. Now, remember that national security or national interest was specifically exempted by Congress as a reason for withholding evidence, so that has no merit here whatsoever. In addition, there's no indication that the Attorney General ever made any such finding. Now, perhaps one of the most amazing things connected with this legal maneuvering around the release of the spectro evidence concerns Robert Werdig's argument when pressed by Lazar to cite a reason why, cite what law was being enforced by the FBI performing the test for the Warren Commission, remember, part of the executive branch. The attorney says, well, it just has to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. Not much of a legal argument. Imagine if you were, if you're a student, if you did not hand in your term paper to your professor on time, and when asked why you did not, you said, well, it just has to be some reason, natural or human. Or imagine if you're at work and you're asked by your boss why you didn't do something, and you gave the excuse, there has to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. Well, you can anticipate the response. So this was the nature of the government's argument here, and the resolution of this particular case, and the government's statement that the Attorney General had determined that release would hurt the country, is covered by Jim Lazar as follows, again from Whitewash Volume 4. Talking about government attorney Werdig here, Robert Werdig. Werdig had another and dirtier trick up his sleeve, one which also helped divert attention from the spurious Williams affidavit. He told Judge Sirica that, quote, in this instance, the Attorney General of the United States has determined that it is not in the national interest to divulge these spectrographic analyses. Because Congress had expressly rejected national interest, unquote, as a grounds for withholding information, Werdig's assertion was at best irrelevant and irresponsible. I now believe that it was worse than that. I believe that no Attorney General has ever made any such determination. No such determination has been produced. In a latter case, the government refused to answer an interrogatory I addressed to it about this, quote, determination, unquote. All of this also detracted from the failure of the Department of Justice to justify its legal position. For example, when pressed to say what law was being enforced by the FBI's investigation for the non-law enforcing Warren Commission, Werdig could do no better than to argue that there just had to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. At the conclusion of oral argument, Judge Sirica, ruling from the bench, granted the government's motion to dismiss. He delivered no opinion and made no findings of fact. So apparently Judge Sirica felt that some law, natural or human, was a good enough excuse for the executive branch of the government to be granted temporary law enforcement powers. However, it's worth noting that eventually the case was overturned on appeal, and the spectrographic evidence upon release confirmed what everybody already knew, which was that the single bullet theory was impossible.
That's right. As a matter of fact, we presented some of that spectrographic evidence and the FBI's response to it and the way they dealt with it in the second part of the program, or the second part of the series. Another comment that, of course, has to be made at this point is when we're talking about that particular Justice Department, I think it also has to be mentioned that the Attorney General at that time, who, whether he did or did not affirm that the national security would be jeopardized, who was in charge of that Justice Department, was, of course, John Mitchell, who I think in 1969, about a year before this happened, was quoted as saying, "This country is going so far to the right you won't recognize it." John Mitchell himself, the chief law enforcement officer of the entire country, who as Attorney General was responsible for, of course, the secret slush fund, bribing of officials, the setting in motion of a chain of events to literally intimidate and lie about other candidates and a variety of other just absolutely sickening, even on the surface, just sickening illegal activities. This was the Justice Department that was fighting to look for some law, natural or human, to deny the spectrographic evidence to Weisberg and Lazar.
By the way, that same Justice Department, Jim Garrison has taken a bad rap from popular American history as having been sort of a publicity seeker, and he was defamed as a result of having been indicted. Now, he was indicted for allegedly skimming profits from pinball machines. He was acquitted of this charge, and the witnesses against him were all basically mafiosi working for Carlos Marcello, who was capo mafioso for New Orleans, and also was one of the prime mafia suspects in the mafia angle of the assassination of President Kennedy. And this suit was brought, was filed under Jim Garrison's Justice, or under John Mitchell's Justice Department, rather.
Indeed.
Detail I forgot to mention when talking about Judge Sirica was that he had campaigned for Richard Nixon in both of his successful presidential campaigns and had contributed money as well.
That's right. So an interesting character who crops up again. Now what we're going to talk about, and somebody that we have mentioned from time to time on both One Step Beyond and Dave Show Hard Rain, is a gentleman by the name of Leon Jaworski, whose name has cropped up in several situations, not only Watergate, which we're going to talk about, and the Kennedy assassination, which we're going to talk about, but of course, more recently in the Koreagate scandal and other things of that ilk.
And in the very beginning of his career, he also was involved with the Nuremberg hearings. So Mr. Jaworski has been there many times when the legal worm has turned, historically speaking. Okay, now, an agreement by agreement, between the presidency and Congress, between President Nixon and Congress, a special prosecutor was set up in order to investigate and prosecute any crimes performed in connection with the Watergate affair. Now, the initial person agreed upon by both Congress and Richard Nixon was a man named Archibald Cox. Now, Archibald Cox was President Kennedy's Solicitor General, and in that capacity had been consulted by President Kennedy with regard to a number of different matters, including the possible arrest of right-winger General Edwin Walker for stirring up trouble when the University of Mississippi was being desegregated in 1962. Worth noting, because Edwin Walker crops up in connection with Lee Harvey Oswald and other people in connection with the investigation. If you'd like to know about that, we'll talk about that in the phone-in section of the program, because we've discussed it before and time marches on. Now, Archibald Cox was very doggedly pursuing the White House tapes, the transcripts of the tapes that we referred to in the portion of the program just concluded. Now, as I mentioned, a White House aide, Alexander Butterfield, had revealed the existence of the White House taping system, and that thereby all Nixon conversations, all conversations in the White House had been taped. Now, Archibald Cox was pursuing the release of some of these transcripts in order to investigate possible criminal wrongdoing in connection with the Watergate affair, and apparently was a little too diligent in his pursuit of these tapes. Nixon attempted to block release of the tapes by claiming executive privilege, and when Archibald Cox would not buy that, in what became known as the Saturday Night Massacre, Richard Nixon fired Archibald Cox and several Justice Department aides who refused to effect the firing of Archibald Cox, including his own attorney general, and basically Richard Nixon fired the congressionally appointed special prosecutor. Now, the man that Richard Nixon named as a successor to Archibald Cox was Leon Jaworski. He was approved by Congress. Now, Leon Jaworski had cropped up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Basically, Jaworski was not only a special Warren Commission counsel, but he was also special counsel to something called the Texas Court of Inquiry. Now, what this was an abortive body set up by then Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr, last name C-A-R-R, to investigate the assassination of President Kennedy for the state of Texas. That investigation never got very far, and Leon Jaworski was named as a special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, and as a special counsel to the Warren Commission, he was in charge of investigating the allegations that Lee Harvey Oswald had been affiliated with either the FBI or the CIA. And picking a man like Leon Jaworski to investigate something like that is very interesting in light of his background.
Indeed, and we're going to read a brief section here again from a book that we just used a few moments ago, Whitewash, Volume 4, by Harold Weisberg, Legal Analysis by Jim Lazar. This is the people that we were talking about in regards to the spectro evidence blocked by the Nixon Justice Department. And here Weisberg is talking about Leon Jaworski and his role in the Kennedy assassination, and later on he also mentions the Watergate affair. And he says, one of the Texas officials, the also respected and wealthy partner in a prestigious Houston law firm, Special Counsel Leon Jaworski, was Rankin's accomplice. And that's J. Lee Rankin, who is a...
J. Lee Rankin, you've got it right.
Okay.
J. Lee Rankin.
All right. As shown by what I used to illustrate the transcript's reference to him, Jaworski was Nixon's second selectee as special Watergate prosecutor, as Dave mentioned, following the fired Archibald Cox. In that role, his record is not inconsistent with his working as the actual boss of the aborted Texas Court of Inquiry. Jaworski should never have accepted his Court of Inquiry post, as he should never have become special prosecutor, because he had a conflict of interest. He had been an active participant in illegal CIA activity, in secret funding of secret CIA fronts domestically. The first suggestion of Oswald as a federal agent, and it was almost immediate, gave Jaworski a conflict he could not resolve. With the abundant reporting of CIA involvement in the Watergate, he faced and ignored the same conflict. Jaworski was and remained on the M.D. Anderson Fund, publicly exposed as a CIA front in the 1967 CIA scandal centering around the National Student Association, which had been financed and seduced by the CIA. One of the abundant sources is a chapter of The Espionage Establishment, an expose of CIA by David Weiss in collaboration with Thomas Ross. So here's Leon Jaworski, who keeps cropping up and essentially is also, and it's important to note, not only show up, but he's been presented by the press to the people of America as the white knight of the American legal system, who comes rushing into these situations where there are, you know, possibilities of government complacence and wrongdoing, like Koreagate, like Watergate, like the Kennedy assassination, although that was being played down very heavily, but it was certainly an element from the very beginning. Leon Jaworski comes riding in on his white steed, the impartial and totally unblemishable patron saint of the legal establishment. Well, indeed, what we find out that all along, Leon Jaworski was fronting the M.D. Anderson Fund, a major CIA front, and a group that was used domestically by the CIA to basically infiltrate and overthrow a whole bunch of student and activist organizations and things of that nature.
Two quick details in connection with that. Interestingly enough, Judge Sarah Hughes, who administered LBJ's oath of office, was the head of another one of these domestic CIA fronts. And now, Leon Jaworski was also named as Koreagate special prosecutor. One of the things that came out in the course of the Koreagate hearings was that the Tongson Park had set up the Moonies as a front for the Korean CIA, which is, of course, very closely affiliated with our CIA. It's interesting because the Moonies were very active on behalf of President Nixon during Watergate. Okay. Now, Leon Jaworski, as special counsel not only to the Texas Court of Inquiry, but also as special counsel to the Warren Commission, was one of just a handful of people who were present on June 7th, 1964 in Dallas, Texas, when basically Jack Ruby, the slayer of Lee Harvey Oswald, was interviewed by the Warren Commission. Now, before reading you some portions of that interview, first of all, I'd like to read you the cast of characters that was present at this interview. Now, I'm reading now from a book called Who is Jack Ruby? This is authored by a man named Seth Cantor, last name K-A-N-T-O-R, and it's published in hardcover by Everest House and is copyrighted 1978. Now, when Jack Ruby was interviewed by the Warren Commission on June 7th, 1964, there were the following people present. First of all, there was Earl Warren, chairman of the Warren Commission and Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. There was also Gerald Ford. Now, Gerald Ford at that time was House Minority Leader. He was the leader of the minority party in the House of Representatives. And he was appointed to the Warren Commission at the instigation of Richard Nixon. Now, Gerald Ford was one of the people present at this Jack Ruby interview. Now, keep in mind that Gerald Ford, after Vice President Agnew was forced from office by a scandal, then House Minority Leader Gerald Ford was named by Richard Nixon as his vice president. Eventually, when Nixon himself was forced from office, Gerald Ford became president of the United States. And within a month after Nixon resigned, Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon for any crimes he may have committed in connection with Watergate. Now, keep in mind that it was at Nixon's instigation that Ford became a Warren Commission member. And Gerald Ford is present at this interview on June 7th, 1964.
Let me make one important clarification from memory. Again, this could be checked, but I believe that what Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon for was any crimes he might have committed while president, which is a much broader sort of basis of things to work with in terms of things we've been talking about tonight and other things. So not just Watergate.
All righty. Now, in addition to Earl Warren and Gerald Ford, present at this particular interview on June 7th, 64, there were two attorneys reading here now from Who Was Jack Ruby by Seth Cantor. Besides the commission members Warren and Ford, there were the commission counsel, Rankin, Joseph A. Ball, and Arlen Specter. Arlen Specter now, by the way, is a senator from Pennsylvania and is sitting on the Senate Judiciary Committee. There were two attorneys, Leon Jaworski and Robert G. Story, representing the official Texas state inquiry into the Kennedy assassination, which was directed by Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr, and which was being muzzled by authorities in Washington. There was Elmer W. Moore, a Secret Service agent, Jim Bowie, an assistant Dallas district attorney, Sheriff Decker, and Tannehill. Now, Joe Tannehill, last name T-O-N-A-H-I-L-L, was Jack Ruby's defense attorney. A number of other people had worked on his defense, including Melvin Belli. Now, Joe Tannehill, keep in mind, he's the man who is defending Jack Ruby, is an interesting person. Reading once again now about Joe Tannehill's background, was this once again from Who Is Jack Ruby by Seth Cantor. Belli gave the impression of an international liberal, an anathema in a Dallas court of law. But Tannehill had the corn pone in him, and his office was a short piece east through the rugged East Texas pines and swamps from Martin Dees Jr. State Park, named after the late communist hunting chairman of what was once the House Un-American Activities Committee on Capitol Hill. Tannehill himself was the son-in-law of the extremely conservative Virginia Congressman Judge Howard W. Smith, the chairman of the House Rules Committee, who had blocked or tried to block almost every piece of progressive Kennedy administration legislation from getting to the House floor for debate. Okay, so Jack Ruby's defense attorney is the son-in-law of one of President Kennedy's fiercest congressional opponents. Keep that in mind, because Tannehill is going to figure very prominently in the verbal sparring which we're about to delve into. Now, keep in mind, this is the interview, what I'm about to read to you here is the actual transcript of the interview that Jack Ruby had with the Warren Commission. Now, the following people, the preceding people, were present. Now, keep in mind, Leon Jaworski, connected with CIA. He was Watergate special prosecutor. Keep in mind, Gerald Ford, who pardoned Richard Nixon. All of these people are present here. Now,
I was just going to mention one other thing to bear in mind here as far as Jack Ruby. Now, we're talking about a man, again, if you some of you missed some of the earlier shows and you're not familiar, Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald ostensibly, and again, this is the Warren Commission's theory or the Warren Commission's reason that has been handed around and is still being used by Life Magazine, Time Inc., and these people as Ruby's justification was essentially that Jack Ruby felt sorry for the grieving widow of President Kennedy, who would have to come back to Dallas and answer questions, and then another story that he supposedly thought he would be a big man and that they would let him off and say, well, Jack, you shouldn't have done it, but we're not really that mad with you. Here, go ahead, now be famous, and people will come by and shake your hand. Well, in reality, as we've mentioned before, and this is just briefly to bring you folks back up to date, Jack Ruby had a lifelong history of ties to the mafia, not only starting way back in the very early days in Chicago when he was a runner for the Capone mob, going straight on up to Havana, Cuba, where he was involved with the Lansky Syndicate and their involvement with the Batista government, who essentially let the mafia run free in Cuba, doing just what they please, raking in millions of dollars from the casinos. So Jack Ruby is a strong gangster connection with strong connections to Cuba, to pre-Castro Cuba, and to a variety of mobsters who are known to be anti-Kennedy and very violently anti-Castro. So this is the man who, just out of altruism and a desire to save the grieving widow of President Kennedy, a man by all rights Jack Ruby should loathe, this is the man who supposedly shot Lee Harvey Oswald for these sort of patently useless reasons. And this is the man who is being interviewed by the Warren Commission with all these people that Dave has mentioned, Jaworski and Ford, et al., and Tannehill, his own lawyer, in the Dallas cell.
Okay, now I'm going to be reading some excerpts here from a book called The Yankee and Cowboy War that we read from before on this program. The Yankee and Cowboy War was authored by Carl Oglesby, O-G-L-E-S-B-Y, published in softcover by Berkeley Medallion Books in 1976. Now, in this book and in many other books on the Kennedy assassination, there are some excerpts here published from Volume 5 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits. And the excerpts I'm going to be reading you here, come from Volume 5, pages 181 through 212. Now, they're reprinted in Yankee and Cowboy War, as they have been in many books, but these excerpts here are actually from Volume 5 of the Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits, page 181 through 212. And the excerpts that I'm going to be reading you here were first made public in August of 1964 by What's My Line columnist and gossip columnist Dorothy Kilgallen. What's My Line panelist and columnist Dorothy Kilgallen, who herself died under very strange circumstances shortly thereafter. We talked about her last week. Okay, keep in mind, all of the people who were present at Jack Ruby's interview with the Warren Commission. This is the actual text, once again, from Volume 5, 181 through 212. 1. This is another man on my staff, Mr. Spector. Would you mind if he came in? Chief Justice Warren introduced the men around the room. Ruby. Is there any way to get me to Washington? Warren. I beg your pardon? Ruby. Is there any way of you getting me to Washington? Warren. I don't know of any. I will be glad to talk to your counsel about what the situation is, Mr. Ruby, when we get an opportunity to talk. Ruby has been intermittently begging a chance to talk to Warren alone. Ruby. By the way, the parenthetical interjections here are stuck in by Oglesby. They're not in the actual text. Ruby. I don't think I will get a fair representation with my counsel, Joe Tannehill. I don't think so. I would like to request that I go to Washington and you take all the tests that I have to take. It is very important. Tannehill. Jack, will you tell him why you don't think you will get a fair representation? Ruby. Because I've been over this for the longest time to get the lie detector test. Somebody has been holding it back from me. Warren. Mr. Ruby, I might say to you that the lateness of this thing is not due to your counsel. It was our own delay due to the pressures we had on us at the time. And still later, Ruby. Gentlemen, unless you get me to Washington, you can't get a fair shake out of me. If you understand my way of talking, you have got to bring me to Washington to get the tests. Do I sound dramatic? Off the beam? Warren. No, you were speaking very, very rationally. And I am really surprised that you can remember as much as you have remembered up to the present time. You have given it to us in great detail. Ruby. Unless you can get me to Washington, and I'm not a crackpot, I have all my senses, I don't want to evade any crime I am guilty of, but, Mr. Moore, have I spoken this way before when we talked? Moore, yes. Elmer W. Moore, by the way, is a Secret Service agent. Ruby, unless you get me to Washington immediately, I'm afraid after what Mr. Tannehill has written there... Well, it is too bad, Chief Warren, that you didn't get me to your headquarters 6 months ago. And still later. Ruby, are you staying overnight here, Chief Warren? Warren. No, I have to be back because we have an early session of court tomorrow morning. Ruby, is there any way of getting the polygraph here? Decker. J.E. Bill Decker, by the way, is the Dallas County Sheriff. He's also present here. Decker, may I make a suggestion, Jack? Listen, you and I have had a lot of dealings. Do you want my officers removed from the room while you talk to this commission? Ruby, that wouldn't prove any truth. Decker, these people came several thousand miles to interview you. You have wanted to tell me your story, and I have refused to let you tell me. Now, be a man with a bunch of men that have come a long way to give an opportunity to Ruby. I wish the president were here right now. It is a terrible ordeal, I'll tell you that. Bill, will you do that for me that you asked a minute ago? You said you wanted to leave the room. Decker, I will have everyone leave the room, including myself, if you want to talk about it. You name it, and out we will go. Ruby, all right. Decker, you want all of us outside? Ruby, yes. Decker, I will leave Tannehill and Moore. I'm not going to have Joe leave. Ruby, if you're not going to have Joe leave, Decker, Moore, his body is responsible to you. His body is responsible to you. Ruby, Bill, I am not accomplishing anything if they are here and Joe Tannehill is here. You asked me anybody I wanted out. Decker, Jack, this is your attorney. This is your lawyer. Ruby, he is not my lawyer. Gentlemen, if you want to hear any further testimony, you will have to get me to Washington soon, because it has something to do with you, Chief Warren. Do I sound sober enough to tell you this? Warren, yes, go right ahead. Ruby, I want to tell the truth, and I can't tell it here. I can't tell it here. Does that make sense to you, Warren? Well, let's not talk about sense, but I really can't see why you can't tell this commission. Ruby, but this isn't the place for me to tell what I want to tell. Moore, the commission is looking into the entire matter, and you're part of it. Should be. Ruby, Chief Warren, your life is in danger in this city. Do you know that, Warren? No, I don't know that. If that is the thing that you don't want to talk about, you can tell me if you wish when this is all over, just between you and me. Ruby, no, I would like to talk to you in private. Warren, you may do that when you finish your story. You may tell me that phase of it. Ruby, I bet you haven't had a witness like me in your whole investigation. Is that correct? Warren, there are many witnesses whose memory has not been as good as yours. I tell you that honestly. Ruby, my reluctance to talk. You haven't had any witness in telling your story and finding so many problems. Warren, you have a greater problem than any witness we've had. Ruby, I have a lot of reasons for having those problems. Warren, I know that. And we want to respect your rights, whatever they may be. And I only want to hear what you are willing to tell us because I realize that you still have a great problem before you, and I'm not trying to press you. Ruby, when are you going back to Washington? Warren, I'm going back very shortly after we finish this hearing. I'm going to have some lunch. Ruby, can I make a statement? Warren, yes. Ruby, if you request me to go back to Washington with you right now, that couldn't be done, could it, Warren? No, it could not be done. It could not be done. There are a good many things involved in that, Mr. Ruby. Ruby, what are they? Warren, well, the public attention that it would attract and the people who would be around. We have no place for you to be safe when we take you out, and we are not law enforcement officers, and it's not our responsibility to go into anything of that kind, and certainly it couldn't be done on a moment's notice this way. Ruby, my life is in danger here. Not with my guilty plea of execution, i.e. not because of killing Oswald. Do I sound sober enough to you as I say this, Warren? You do. You sound entirely sober. Ruby, from the moment I started my testimony, have I sounded as though, with the exception of becoming emotional, haven't I sounded as though I made sense what I was speaking about, Warren? You have indeed. I understand everything you have said. If I haven't, it's my fault. Ruby, then I follow this up. I may not live tomorrow to give any further testimony. The reason why I add this to this, since you assure me that I have been making sense by then, I might be speaking sense by following what I have said, and the only thing I want to get out to the public, and I can't say it here, is with authenticity, with sincerity of the truth of everything and why my act was committed. But it can't be said here. It can be said. It's got to be said amongst people of the highest authority that would give me the benefit of the doubt. And following that, immediately give me the lie detector test after I do make the statement. Chairman Warren, If you felt that your life was in danger at the moment, how would you feel? Wouldn't you be reluctant to go on speaking, even though you request me to do so? One. I think I might have some reluctance if I was in your position. Yes, I think I would. I think I would figure it out very carefully as to whether it would endanger me or not. If you think that anything that I am doing or anything that I am asking you is endangering you in any way, shape, or form, I want you to feel absolutely free to say that the interview is over. Ruby, what happens then? I didn't accomplish anything. Warren, no, nothing has been accomplished. Ruby, well, then you won't follow up with anything further? Warren, there wouldn't be anything to follow up if you hadn't completed your statement. Ruby, you said you have the power to do what you want to do. Is that correct? Warren, exactly. Ruby, without any limitations? Warren, within the purview of the executive order which established the commission, Ruby, but you don't have a right to take a prisoner back with you when you want to? Warren, no. We have the power to subpoena witnesses to Washington if we want to do it. But we have taken the testimony of 200 or 300 people, I would imagine, here in Dallas without going to Washington. Ruby, yes, but those people aren't Jack Ruby. Warren, no, they weren't. Ruby, they weren't. Warren, now, I want you to feel that we are not here to take any advantage of you because I know that you are in a delicate position. And unless you would indicate it not only through your letters, but also through your sister who wrote a letter addressed either to me or to Mr. Rankin saying you wanted to testify before the commission, unless she had told us that, I wouldn't have bothered you. Ruby, the thing is that with your power that you have, Chief Justice Warren, and all these gentlemen, too much time has gone by for me to give you any benefit of what I may say now. And still later. Rankin, it isn't entirely clear how you feel that your family and you yourself are threatened by your telling what you have to the commission. How do you come to the conclusion that they might be killed? Will you tell us a little bit more about that, if you can, Ruby? Well, assuming that, as I stated before, some persons are accusing me falsely of being part of the plot, naturally, in all the time from over 6 months ago, my family has been so interested in helping me. Rankin, by that you mean a party to the plot of Oswald? Ruby, that I was a party to a plot to silence Oswald. Warren, Mr. Ruby, I think you are entitled to a statement to this effect because you have been frank with us and you have told us your story. I think I can say to you that there has been no witness before this commission out of the hundreds we have questioned who has claimed to have any personal knowledge that you were a party to any conspiracy to kill our president. Ruby, yes, but you don't know this area here. Warren, well, I will make this additional statement to you, that if any witness should testify before the commission that you were, to their knowledge, a party to any conspiracy to assassinate the president, I assure you that we will give you the opportunity to deny it and to take any test that you may so desire to disprove it. Ruby, and I wish that our beloved President Lyndon Johnson would have delved deeper into the situation. Hear me. Not to accept just circumstantial facts about my guilt or innocence and would have questioned to find out the truth about me before he relinquished certain powers to these certain people. Consequently, a whole new form of government is going to take over our country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. Do I sound sort of screwing in telling you these things, Warren? No, I think that is what you believe, or you wouldn't tell it under oath, Ruby. But it is a very serious situation. I guess it's too late to stop it, isn't it? And still later. Ford, are there any questions that ought to be asked to help clarify the situation that you described? Ruby, there is only one thing. If you don't get me back to Washington tonight to give me a chance to prove to the president that I am not guilty, then you will see the most tragic thing that will ever happen. And still later, Ruby, now maybe something can be saved. It may not be too late, whatever happens, if our President Lyndon Johnson knew the truth from me. But if I am eliminated, there won't be any way of knowing. Right now, when I leave your presence now, I am the only one that can bring out the truth to our president who believes in righteousness and justice. But he has been told, I am certain, that I was part of a plot to assassinate the president. I know, your hands are tied, you are helpless. Warren, Mr. Ruby, I think I can say this to you, that if he has been told any such thing, there is no indication of any kind that he believes it. Ruby, I'm sorry, Chief Justice Warren. I thought I would be very effective in telling you what I have said here, but in all fairness to everyone, maybe all I want to do is to beg that if they found out I was telling the truth, maybe they can succeed in what their motives are, but maybe my people won't be tortured and mutilated.